Hello, this is The Green Report, Rappler's show on the environment and the stories of people whose decisions impact the world around us. I'm G. Geronimo.
And I'm Ia Gozum.
We're just weeks away from the annual United Nations Climate Change Conference, or COP28, happening in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. This year's conference of the parties will focus heavily on the first ever global stocktake, a process for governments and other stakeholders to track and evaluate their progress toward meeting the goals of the Paris Agreement. This COP will also hold its first ever Local Climate Action Summit, a gathering that focuses on the critical role that local leaders play in climate action and progress. With us today is C40 Cities Executive Director Mark Watts to talk more about the work they do with cities around the world to address climate change. Hello, Mark.
Hi.
Welcome to the Philippines. This is your first time in the Philippines.
It's my very first time.
How are you finding it so far?
Well, I've been here less than 24 hours. I've had a wonderful meeting with Mayor Joy Belmonte, so that's been very inspiring. But I'm looking forward to getting out and seeing a bit of the city.
How about the climate?
You know, I've been in Bangkok just a few days before, Singapore before that, Shanghai and some Chinese cities for the previous week. So I've just about acclimatized, but the humidity is what I struggle with.
It is a bit similar, right?
With it feels a bit similar.
Right. So for those who are not familiar with the work that you do at C40 Cities, can you just talk a bit more about the organization and what you do with cities around the world?
Yeah, so we're, despite the name, we're a network of nearly 100 of the biggest, the most influential cities in the world. So Quezon City is a member, the member from the Philippines, but it's also London, Paris, New York, Tokyo, Beijing, Shanghai, Lagos, Johannesburg, you know, the big cities all around the world. We're entirely focused on climate change and equity, so how to reduce emissions, improve resilience and improve equity, more equal societies. And we're unusual in that, you know, there's lots of these city types of organisations. Most of them, you pay a membership fee and you're able to join. In C40, there's no membership fee. It's invitation only. And you only get to retain your membership if you meet our leadership standards. And those leadership standards are all about reducing emissions or constraining emissions in line with what the science says is necessary, the Paris Agreement requires, so that we can keep global temperature rise below 1.5 degrees, which obviously is now looking very, very difficult. But also it's about participation. So we're about a club where the cities share with each other, the mayors help each other to move faster in improving their cities. And that means you've got to participate. So to stay in C40, you've got to be active.
When you say participate or you have to be active, what does that mean in the context of the organization?
That means that the mayor or the governor personally has to attend C40 events, has to go on virtual calls with other mayors, that city officials at all levels, you know, we've got lots of different networks, so looking at how do you clean up your transport, move faster to electric vehicles, to more public transport, walking and cycling, or how do you manage water, or how do you manage waste, or, you know, a thing I'm really looking forward to seeing here in this city, how do you have urban farming and provide good, healthy food, but that's grown within the city. So all of those things, we've got networks on those things. The cities have to have officials that participate in those networks. And then you've got to share your best practice. You've got to tell other cities, you know, Mayor Joy is telling other cities, how is it that she's managed to create 25,000 jobs in urban farming in this city? Lots of other cities would like to copy that. They can do it much more quickly, more efficiently, if they learn from Quezon City rather than having to start and do it all themselves.
Right. You talked about the Paris Agreement earlier. So what is the role of cities when in terms of limiting the global temperature to 1.5 degrees Celsius?
Well, that's an interesting question. So, you know, as you both well know, the COP itself, the official intergovernmental process, is just about national governments negotiating with each other. It doesn't include local government. But when you come to the reality of actually taking action on climate, in just the C40 cities, the 97 cities, they represent 800 million people if you take the metropolitan area of those cities. A quarter of the global economy is generated in those cities. Yeah. So what they do really dictates global markets, global trends and global emissions. And what we've found is this: it's much easier and city leaders are much more likely to collaborate with each other rather than fighting with each other when it comes to global challenges like climate change. And there's a good reason for that. When governments disagree with each other, they've got armies and they end up having a war, or they put up trade barriers. City governments don't have those things. So instead, when they're competing for investment or to attract the best people or tourists, they compete by copying the best ideas from each other. Mm-hmm. It's a race. If London has, as it has done, got a brilliant big low emission zone, there's 20 other cities across mm-hmm. the world now that think we've got to do the same thing, otherwise London becomes a more attractive place than our city. So actually, what the role of cities, we think, in the COP and in climate is to be the leaders within government and political leadership, showing that you can have prosperous societies where people can thrive right. that are also low carbon. And it's, our big cities, they're the place where people dream of living, right. where dreams are made, where the future happens first in these big cities. So if they can show that it's possible to stay within that 1.5 degree limit, then we hope that the rest of the world will see that's a reality that's available to everybody.
You talked about the dream of living in a city. In the Philippines, that's especially true because people from the provinces, they would always, or from the rural areas, yeah. right? They would always like send their children to school here in Manila, in the cities. And that's their dream, to be here, because being here means jobs, means opportunities. Mm. Although I have to ask, is it easier to organize local governments rather than, say, national governments? Because you mentioned that, countries, national governments dealing with nations, they have armies, they have all these resources, all these politics. But with local governments, you have cities competing with the best practices, with best ideas. Is it easier or are there a lot of things that are more feasible to do with local governments than, say, countries?
I don't think there's any. I don't think the way that intergovernmental politics is currently run is the way it has to be. This is a 18th century, 19th century construct when the nation state right, really came right. into being.
And that's interesting.
And we're trying to solve 21st century problems when no one even, climate change didn't exist. So, in many ways, the way that cities work with each other is the model I think you would want to see happening intergovernmentally as well. Let's agree on a common problem and then let's put aside the other differences and try and find a solution. But, at the moment, the way things are, yes, it's somewhat easier to work with cities. You can, and the evidence is it's working. 75% of our member cities are cutting emissions per person faster than their respective nation states. And to be honest, the ones that it's not true, it's either because they did so much in the previous decade that they're so far ahead, or we just haven't got the data. Generally, action at a local level has gone a lot faster than at a national level.
You've said earlier that C40 is an invitation-only organization. What is it about Belmonte's leadership or Quezon City in general that made them a member of C40?
Well, we always look for things that are unique to one place but that other cities would want to copy. And so, certainly the things at the moment, the fact that Quezon City was one of the first cities to start to ban single-use plastics, which we know particularly in this part of the world is such a big problem in terms of affecting the oceans, clogging up the oceans with plastics, affecting flood management within cities, but as well as the carbon emissions. So that was interesting to other cities. The thing that's really caught my imagination and that where Mayor Belmonte has been an incredible leader within C40 is that move during the pandemic when the city was struggling to get the right food supplies in and there was loss of employment for lots of people within the cities, to see that there was an opportunity to have urban agriculture that could produce healthy food, create jobs, I think 25,000 jobs now created in that urban agriculture program, and link that also to a program of healthy meals in schools so that people start life with healthier food. Because we know, food is one of the areas where there's huge amounts of carbon emissions globally. Agriculture, as much as 25-30% of global emissions, but not a huge amount of action agreed internationally. So there are lots and lots of cities looking at what Quezon City is doing on that.
All right. And in the here with the Metro Manila cities, after the pandemic, a lot of cities are removing their bike lanes. But Quezon City is the sole city that's actually expanding their bike lanes now. Anyway, are there other cities in the Philippines that you see as promising as Quezon City or?
Well, this is my first ever time in the Philippines. Oh, I'm ashamed to say so.
And without even 24 hours.
You're already asking for another city.
But I'm really pleased to hear you say that about the cycle lanes because it's not possible to have a sustainable city without sustainable transport. And the bedrock of that in the really big cities has to be public transport, mass transit. Mm-hmm. But actually, I think there's still such untapped potential for allowing people the freedom to be able to ride a bike. And this is actually how I started my career in government, in city government in London. One of the things I worked on was introducing cycle lanes across London when I worked for former Mayor Ken Livingstone. And it was amazing at that time. This is, I mean, I'm old, so this is going back 20 years, but when I first proposed in the Mayor's Cabinet that we should start investing in cycle lanes, I was quite literally laughed at. Because, you know, all the older transport professionals just thought, this is rubbish. We want to get people around.
Really, they need first world city?
They want to be on metro. Yeah, exactly. First world city. We're not going backwards to the old days when people cycled. And I think at that time we invested something like out of a transport budget of £3 billion, I think £5 million was put into cycling. And I just asked for 50 million. I said, increase it by 10 times, but it's still only 50 million.
Right, right.
And let's see what we can do. And you, the change, and I'm not claiming anything like the credit for it, but the change is, as progressive mayors, the current mayor, Sadiq Khan, has really invested in cycling. It's now gone from something like 0.2% of trips by bicycle to over 5%. And in some of the areas where younger people live, the travel, the commute to work in the morning, 20 or even 30% of trips by bike. And these people, they're healthier as a result of it. The air pollution is going down because we're taking out cars, and even the old buses were polluting. And it's just a joy to see people, using human power on a
There's something
power.
About people biking. But how long did that take, that change?
I mean, it's been a transition over 20... We started that 2001, 2002, 22 years.
If it took you 20 years, how long will it take us?
But actually, it's a really big change to go from 0.2% to 5%. Right. You know, you ask the transport officials who are desperately working out how to add capacity to a metro or to a bus, and we're confronting hundreds of millions or billions of cost in doing that. All they're trying to do is add capacity of 0.5% or 1%. So that cycling is so cheap to get really big benefits.
You know, cycling is really a rabbit hole. One day you're riding a bike, the next day you're a climate activist. Anyway, speaking of clean transport, just to help our viewers and our listeners visualize, what a green city is, what are clean infrastructure or measures that you hope to see in many cities in the future?
Well, I think I have a bit just seen the future. I've just been in Shanghai and Guangzhou. Cities that I've been, in the case of Shanghai, I've been visiting on and off over 20 years, but hadn't been back to since the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And the change is so extraordinary. And these were a really congested, quite dirty city, really noisy with all of the traffic pollution, and quite grey, really, with all the concrete and infrastructure, this massive infrastructure that had been built very, very quickly. And they had, the first time I was there, I think they were just finishing the second metro line. Now in Shanghai, 17 metro lines and a further 10 under construction. 90% of all the buses on the road, and there are 13,000 of them, so a very, very big fleet, are electric. They'll finish the final 10% very soon. 100% of all the taxis are electric. 100% of all the mopeds are electric. And 34% of the cars on the road are electric. And the result is, you can see the sky again, it's blue, which has a beautiful contrast now with all the greenery that's been, it looks like Singapore now, sort of green everywhere, flowers lining the roads, trees everywhere, parks being, as they expand the city, they're putting in huge amounts of parks. And it's so much quieter, because electric vehicles produce almost no noise. Yeah. So I'm not saying it's perfect. It is not perfect. No big city is perfect, but you can see there what's possible in a really big city in a relatively short space of time. And what isn't there, given what we've just been talking about, that I was a bit disappointed at the level of cycling, because there were more people cycling last time I was there. I don't know what's happened there, but if you could combine that perhaps with the way that Copenhagen and Amsterdam in Europe have got sometimes half of the people travelling to work do so by bike in a very walkable city where the river is also used. Now, that's my vision of what a clean green transport system looks like.
Right.
Is it a pipe dream?
I don't want
for the Philippines?
It's not, because, this change is happening in China in a really short space of time. And I think it shows what you can do if there's a real focus and all the different levels of government come together, you know, and that's the challenge in most parts of the world to get that coherence. But, you know, for example, China didn't, when it started out dealing with what was the worst air pollution in the world in its cities, only a decade ago, it didn't have an electric bus infrastructure. It didn't have electric bus, electric vehicle manufacturing capacity. It's had to create that itself to solve a problem. And in under a decade, Beijing has halved its air pollution. You know, cut it in half is an extraordinary thing to do. But part of the way to that, Guangzhou, where I was, when the city there was couldn't get the kind of shift to electric vehicles that it needed to reduce air pollution, to save people's lives, improve health, they invested in creating their own electric car company. It's now the third biggest electric vehicle manufacturer in the world, and it's owned by the city government.
So how do you think those who have a stake here, how do we rally our local leaders to really include climate change in their processes and plans? And how do your member cities do it? And how do their residents do it?
Well, I think you can't beat just speaking the truth as a start. And I know that's what you know what you do as journalists. But that the necessity of... This is a crisis on the climate. There's no other way around it. I'm an optimist, and I love to talk about the positive change and how things are getting better, which they are in many ways. But the future of human life is under threat unless we can rapidly and very significantly cut emissions. And rapidly means in the next 3-4 years, not in a decade. And so there's no substitute for just speaking the truth to power, just keeping up that pressure. It's a climate emergency. You expect your leaders to be involved in solving it. But I think the second thing, and perhaps this is harder, particularly when we have a very vibrant youth forum in C40 that we connect local young leaders from all around the world together. It's one thing standing up and protesting when political leaders are doing the wrong thing, but you also need to help them when they're doing the right thing.
Right.
Because particularly what I see at the moment is in our cities around the world, because there is so much money to be made still in selling oil and gas and dirty old polluting cars and badly built homes and offices, that whenever a mayor does something to bring in a new building code, a green building code, as is being brought in Quezon City, that's designed to help improve air pollution, reduce emissions, make built offices better places to live, homes better places to live, there's going to be someone who's going to put a lot of money in trying to stop that because they think it's going to hit their profit margin.
Yeah.
Or we see in the cities that have introduced clean air zones, often a huge lobby to try and prevent those measures, saying it's going to hurt jobs, no truth in that whatsoever, saying it's going to make it harder to get around the city. So you need people to stand up and support, you know, support those measures when it's the right thing to do. And often that's a harder thing to do because you might not agree with the politician on everything else, but back them when they do the right thing on the environment.
But how are you seeing in the cities that you work with? Are there more and more clamor for this coming from the residents, from young people, to speak to their local leaders to urge them to really go green in their policies?
Yeah, I mean, in general, in the time I've been working on this, climate and the environment in general has gone from being just a fringe issue that registered in opinion polls to now often air pollution being the top or one of the top three issues in lots of the big cities around the world because, you know, very sadly, there's no big city in the world that has air that the World Health Organization says is clean, fit to breathe.
Right.
So that's really changed. I think now what you also see, though, is there's lots of business leaders that really want to use the power of their businesses to be mission-driven to help change the world as well and are ready to work with city governments. Certainly the youth movement has been the absolute strongest in really pushing that message about the climate emergency, but there are lots of older people's organisations that we work with as well around the world and, you know, parents. The Mums for Lungs in Los Angeles, the same Mums for Lungs in London, totally different community organisations of... Basically, it's mostly mothers, but parents who've just got worried about the air their kids are breathing in when they take them to school.
Right. And some people might wonder, with the enormity of the climate task, why cities? Why should we start with cities? Or what can cities really do?
Well, I think start with what you can affect. Start with where you live. mm-hmm. change the place that you live, be part of that change. And because of the nature of the job, mayors of cities are much closer to the local population than presidents and prime ministers, because you expect your mayor to be responsible for making sure that the roads are working, mm. the waste mm. is collected, and you blame them if they're not. So it's a more practical kind of job. It's a kind of doing things, getting things done, not kind of setting laws that last for many years and negotiating sort of trade agreements. But I think, you know, even more, it's sort of where we started this conversation is it's a pretty terrible situation where we've known all the dangers of climate breakdown for mm-hmm. 30 years. There have been treaties on it for 25 years mm-hmm. and still emissions are going up. Last year, when we know there shouldn't be a single dollar or cent invested in any new fossil fuels, oil, gas or coal, last year broke all records for the highest ever investment in wow. fossil fuels. So we're going in the wrong direction. But here's a group of political leaders at the city level mm-hmm. that have recognised that, recognised the climate emergency. If they're a member of C40, they've put in place a real robust plan for how to cut emissions mm-hmm. and they're working together. They're willing to collaborate across different cultures, levels of economic development, different politics. You really don't see arguments in C40 when these mayors from all those different places come together. They're united in how they can tackle climate change and learn from each other. And I think I find that really inspiring. You know, I hope other people do.
Or they outdo each other in what they do in the climate.
I mean, healthy competition. Right. It should be.
They all say the same thing. They come together at a C40 meeting to steal from each other. But they're not picking the pocket. They're just stealing an idea.
Right.
That's a good kind of stealing.
Yeah.
Well. Yeah, we should encourage that kind of.
How do you see national governments supporting these efforts from local governments? How do you see these two spheres working together, coming together?
Well, you know, there are some national governments that work very seamlessly at a local level, but it's not true generally. What we're saying at this COP that's going to be in a few weeks' time in Dubai, COP28, is look at what's being, to national governments, look at what's being delivered at the city level and really look at it properly. So we've done some research on this. We think that only about 30% of the nationally determined contributions, so the pledges that national governments have made for what their country will do to cut emissions under the Paris Agreement, we think only 30% of that have actually really considered what's being delivered at the city scale. Mm-hmm. So even if they just properly looked at it, they could increase the national commitment overnight. So one, have a proper look at it. But two, you know, thanks to the United Arab Emirates, and it's as a climate campaigner, it's a difficult thing to have a petrostate leading a climate talk.
That's true.
But in all fairness, they've done something that's never happened before. They've created within the COP itself, the formal talks, a big space. There's going to be a local action, a local leaders action mm-hmm. summit that will bring together mayors, governors. So Governor of California, Gavin Newsom, was in China at mm-hmm. the same time I was. You can see the effects that his leadership in California is having. So mayors and governors, along with then ministers, prime ministers, presidents, to have one conversation. And we've got a very specific ask, which is then, having seen that, had that conversation, mm-hmm. we'd like the first few governments to come together and say that from now on, they'll work with city leaders before each COP. Yeah. So they'll take into account what's being introduced in the city. They'll then look at the extra powers the mayors need, or the extra funding the mayors need, or the ability to bring together different parts of national government to help them deliver the city commitments. And then when they come to COPs in future, it won't just be with a pledge from the national government, mm-hmm. it will be with a pledge from all layers of government within the country.
Right.
Maybe that could also reshape the framework that we're pursuing in climate action around the world, you know, getting the global cities more and more into the fold and not just thinking country-wise. As you said, it's like an old kind of thinking, right?
Involving the climate, the cities in the climate talks.
And then we do have to then change the way that global finance works.
That's true.
That's another topic.
That's another topic for another podcast. Well, I have so much to say about accessing climate finance.
Yeah.
Right. But what do you expect from this year's? You mentioned the summit, but what do you expect out of that summit? And since it's the first ever and it's happening here at COP28, what do you want to see the governments produce from that summit?
Well, I think from the Local Leaders Action Summit, I'm hoping this is not the only time that local leaders are in the tent of the COP, part of the formal proceeding. It's the first time, and every COP thereafter will be the same. And I hope that we do get, let's just say, four or five governments that are willing to stand up at this COP and say, yeah, we recognise there's a lot happening at the local level that, that we're not taking account of, that we could support more. Because then by the time we come to COP 30, which will be in Brazil, by which time under the Paris Agreement, every government has got to have brought their national commitment actually in line with what the science says is necessary. Right. We know almost none of them at the moment are anywhere near that. That they'll see working with governors, working with mayors as an opportunity, not a threat, an opportunity to bring that greater level of ambition. You know, the COP itself, and we can see the big thing that the UAE is trying to achieve is to get a commitment to treble the scale of renewable energy by 2030. I think that's possible. I hope that'll be an outcome. It's not enough. That's the trouble, because we can't solve the climate crisis by just building more green stuff. We've got to stop producing the pollution. So we've got to stop burning fossil fuels. And that's the really difficult thing. I don't think we're going to get a breakthrough on that this COP.
Sure, we hit the snag, stopping pollution.
it's a pretty obvious, isn't it? Yeah, but there's never been a COP. I think, you know, for most ordinary people, it's impossible to believe. We had 28 years of climate talks. There's never been an agreement to cut oil or gas.
To phase out, right?
Coal to phase out, but oil and gas, not even that. Mm-hmm. There's never been any agreement to reduce oil and gas production. Mm-hmm. And this is what's killing us. So this has got to be, if it's not this COP, it's got to be the next COP. You do see it at a city level, however.
Right.
So we've made a C40 as a whole. Our mission is not just to cut emissions. Our mission is to halve the use of fossil fuel in our member cities by 2030.
Speaking of COP, I'd like to end with this. What do you think, what are you hoping out of the COP28 in terms of local leaders being heard at the table?
Well, I hope the speeches and the contributions from the mayors at the local leaders summit are so amazing that next time they want them in the main sessions itself. they want all that positivity, all that energy. I'd like to hear in the corridors. I'd like to hear prime ministers stopping mayors and saying, "How is it that you all work together? How come Chinese and American cities can work really well together? Filipino cities are copying ideas from their African counterpart. How is that happening?" When we're not able to do that, and then maybe that magic kind of brushes off and we start to see a change in the way that governments relate to each other.
Well, that's our hope for this COP28.
We have a lot of hope.
What's really inspiring about cities doing their part in the climate task is that it's really inspiring because it's small places doing, showing the world that it can be done. That it's not an impossible task.
So. We're talking about small places, but we're also talking about dense populations.
Right. Mm.
So, and
places where there are a lot of people who really want to see their cities changed for the climate. Thank you so much, Mark, for talking to us. We really loved having you here. And that's a wrap. Thank you for tuning in. If you have any story ideas to pitch, you can reach us at G Geronimo or at Ia Gozum for Ia on X. See you in the next episode.
Bye.
Bye.